Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and it was all hugs last Thursday when Mayor de Blasio announced a tentative new contract with the teachers union. Did you ever think you'd see a New York City mayor and UFT president share a bro hug? But the real work around the contract is just getting going. Yesterday, teachers union delegates voted to recommend the new contract to the rank and file, and now it's up to the tens of thousands of teachers, around 100,000 really, themselves. And this afternoon, Mayor de Blasio will lay out his 2015 executive budget, which will have some details about how the city plans to pay for the retroactive raises and other elements of the contract. Well, by the way, on the mayor's 53rd birthday today, how did you spend your birthday? Oh, I gave an executive budget briefing. Fun. Anyway, let's talk about the teachers' deal and the ripple effect on other municipal contracts with Richard Steyer, editor and columnist for The Chief Leader, which reports on labor and politics in New York. His new book is perfect for this moment. It's called Enough Blame to Go Around, The Labor Pains of New York City's Public Employee Unions. Richard Steyer, welcome to WNYC.
How are you, Brian?
Good, thank you. And I mentioned the vote by union delegates last night, but by all accounts we're seeing, it was not an enthusiastic vote. I know of one school where there was a big debate about whether their delegate would support the new contract that we ultimately did. Is there any chance that it won't get approved? And is there less enthusiasm among the rank and file than there seemed to be in the media a week ago?
There's always a chance that it won't get approved, but the likelihood would appear to be that it is going to go through, even if some teachers are holding their nose as they vote yes.
Education advocate Diane Ravitch generally praised the deal, but she posted a letter on her blog over the weekend from one teacher panning the deal. It read sarcastically, "Being a teacher, I don't know a whole lot about money. Still, I'm fairly certain that money has more value in 2010 than 2020, when we will finally be made whole, because the retro pay is actually spread out until 2020. That letter continues, "It's plainly disingenuous to argue we have parity with the other unions." What do you make of that argument, and how deep-seated is that complaint? How widespread?
There is validity to that argument because of the delays in payment. Traditionally, you would have a situation in which a contract would get ratified. In the next paycheck after that, people would see the raises that they were entitled to at that point. And in a paycheck after that, typically they would get their retroactive money. Here, it's working on a very delayed fuse that basically, in terms of the raises themselves, even though they apply to 2009 and 2010, they are not going to begin to be implemented until 2015 at the rate of 2% a year up through 2018, which is the last year of the tentative contract. In terms of the retro money actually being paid out, that also isn't beginning until 2015. Then it's skipping a year in 2016 and resuming in 2017 through 2020. And 75% of the retro money is going to be paid in that final three-year period, 2 years of which fall after this contract has expired.
2019 and 2020. So these retro payments, which are from years before this year, won't get paid until and unless the next UFT contract continues to include them. By the way, listeners, if you want to see a graphic representation of this, we posted on our website a chart that the UFT sent around to its members outlining the timing of the payments. And let's just say, horizontally speaking, it's a very long chart. Here is Mayor de Blasio from this program last Friday talking about the biggest economic component of the agreement, how the city is going to find $1 billion plus in health care savings without requiring contributions to the premiums from the teachers. Take a listen, and you will hear a follow-up question from me.
For the first time, that was brought to the table in a coherent fashion, and labor agreed cooperatively to turn turn the supertanker, bend the cost curve, actually start to reduce health care costs. This now opens the door for an ongoing effort over years and years to continue that effort and actually fundamentally address a long-term liability.
But let me ask you again, will that likely mean less choice of doctors for participating teachers if some of the early emphasis here is on centralized locations for providing services? And can you describe these health centers of excellence, as Boblin called them, in more detail?
Again, because this is all part of an ongoing negotiation, I'm going to be broad on purpose. The menu of options, Bob gave some examples, allows each union to work with us to decide what works best for them.
Mayor de Blasio on our show last Friday, and Richard Steyer from the Chief Leader and author of Enough Blame to Go Around, The Labor Pains of New York City's Public Employee Unions. Using the phrase, I'm being broad on purpose, something you don't hear that often from a politician, acknowledging that he's not giving a specific answer to a question by design. But does it really come down to that menu of options? Do you have details on what's included? And will teachers be encouraged to go to centralized, medical services delivery locations and lose choice of doctors?
What they were talking about last week, for the most part, came down to prescription drugs being obtained through a central facility and also something like radiology being performed at a central facility rather than at a doctor's office. I have to think that one of the prime people behind this was Stanley Brezhnev, who the mayor went out of his way to thank at the press conference last week. He's his special advisor on labor. But Bob Lynn is knowledgeable enough about all the facets of labor that I have the feeling that Brezhnev's experience running hospitals and managing hospitals for a consortium are really what was drawn upon in terms of looking at some of these savings.
And this morning, WNYC's Bridget Bergen reported an excellent piece about a union that might serve as a model for the teachers, the hotel workers. That's in the private sector. But at the heart of their health plan are five health care centers around the city, paid for by management but operated by the union's nonprofit. And the hotel union claims that they're able to save about 35% compared to the open market and provide full services to their members at no extra cost. And we heard clips in Bridget's piece about some members complaining that there are only five of these locations around the city, so they have to travel a lot to get their medical care, and they don't like that they can't go outside for doctors. But by the same token, the report was that in a user satisfaction survey, they got a 90% plus positive rating. So this may be the kind of experiment that we see more of throughout America, public and private sectors. We're going to have a similar conversation about New York State Obamacare plans later in the show, Richard. Maybe less choice of doctors is one of the things that America is facing to get the cost curve under control for health care.
It could well be. And for a lot of people, I think that having your own doctor is something that gives you a comfort level. And some people may be pushed away from that. It remains to be seen just how they're going to go about doing it. But essentially, this is a menu that they're picking. They're looking to get savings. I don't think the administration is married to getting it any one particular way. And that's the reason that they did not insist that employees pay a portion of their health premiums as part of this deal.
Listeners, if you are in the teachers union, call up and tell us if you're going to ratify this contract, and if so, with what level of enthusiasm. And if you're in any other city workers union, call up and tell us if you're going to resist the details of this contract, be it on health care, be it on retro raises, since just about all the city unions were without a contract over the last years of the Bloomberg administration. Is this pattern okay with you? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And I guess I should mention that from what we can tell, all the pushback on the part of the teachers is about the retro pay and the way it's spread out over so much time, not so much pushback on the health care elements of it, though we'll see what comes to pass over time. But teachers and other city workers, 212-433-9692, as we continue with Richard Steyer, editor and columnist for The Chief Leader, the newspaper that reports on New York City labor. And he's the author of a new book called Enough Blame to Go Around, The Labor Pains of New York City's Public Employee Unions. So let's talk about the other unions, Richard. In DNA info on that website, I saw the headline, NYPD union blasts de Blasio offer of no retro raises despite UFT deal, unquote. So how is it that the UFT would get retro raises but not the police union? Is that the plan?
Well, basically, it's not anything in terms of inequality. What happened was that the police unions had all gotten these raises back in the area of 2008, 2009, when the mayor was still negotiating with the labor force. Close to 60% of the unions got the 2-4% increases back then. Then you had the Wall Street meltdown, you had the national financial crisis, and the mayor declared in mid-bargaining round that he could no longer honor the bargaining pattern, even though he had spent most of his administration citing the importance of preserving bargaining patterns while he was going through arbitration proceedings with the PBA. So that, in essence, once you come out of that period, in the UFT contract, there is an 18-month period after those raises take effect in which there is no raise. There is a $1,000 bonus in lieu of a raise, which looks good in terms of cash, but comes off the payroll right away. It can't be used in terms of future salary. It can't be used in terms of pensions. That's the thing that has those unions upset, both in terms of the lack of the raise and the symbolic issue of not giving police officers raises in any particular year. They still are sore about the Zeros for Heroes contract that they received through arbitration under Rudy Giuliani going back 17 years ago. Once you get beyond that, there is a 1% raise that takes effect last year and a 1% raise that takes effect now for the UFT. In terms of the pattern for the PBA, essentially it would wind up being, I think, just that 1% would be applicable retroactively because they're on a slightly different contract cycle than the teachers. And so they'd be seeing very little retroactive money if they went in and agreed to similar terms, which they are not going to do.
I asked the mayor about the police union negotiations when he was here the other day in light of the UFT deal, and here's what he had to say.
If, in fact, this deal is ratified by the teachers, and if, in fact, the Municipal Labor Council supports the health care provisions, we will clearly have established a pattern. And then I think unions will work from that assumption.
And he used the word pattern in his response. That's no accident. Want to talk about the idea of patterning in the negotiations and how the UFT sets up a pattern for the rest of the 151 other city workers' unions?
It has always been believed that if you have a strong established union agreeing to a contract, that that will serve as a pattern from which other unions will have to work. And it's not necessarily an absolute pattern. There have been cases in the past in which the police unions, particularly when Ed Koch was mayor, got slightly more than the civilian unions like the teachers and District Council 37 and Teamsters Local 237 received. But it does limit the options that unions have for the most part. The PBA has had some success since it came under the state arbitration system, which is known as the Public Employment Relations Board, of doing slightly better than what the existing pattern was. And that's why the PBA has already looked to go into arbitration and is beginning mediation with an eye to going to eventual arbitration. But there is no guarantee that they're going to do better. There are risks for both sides in an arbitration proceeding. But that's certainly the way that the PBA is going to go.
Matthew in Flushing, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Matthew.
Good morning, Brian. So nice to talk to you. So I'm a public school teacher. I've been teaching 13 years. I teach Latin in a high school in Queens. Mm-hmm. And I just would like to talk about basically the impression I've gotten from most of the people I've talked to in my school and from our chapter leader is that the deal is, it seems really great, you know, all this money, the $1,000 bonus and everything. The fact that it takes so long and it's such a slow pay schedule, really 6 more years until we're made whole, that actually depreciates the amount of money that we're going to get in the long run because, just simple inflation. The a dollar in 2020 is going to be very different than a dollar would have been in 2009. And so that's an argument I often hear put up against it. I should say, by the way, I'm probably going to vote for it just because it is actually an increase and it is something more than nothing. And the other big gripe, I guess, I have with it, is not gripe, but danger I see in it, is the fact that the ATR, the so-called absent teacher reserve, is their tenure is going to be kind of weakened now because, from what I understand, the new rule says that they have to be put into two different schools, at least at most two, and if the principal is there...
To give a tryout, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And if they rate them ineffectively, then they can start termination procedures against them. So even if they have tenure. So that is scary, I think, just because, you know, it's certainly would seem like the beginning of a...
Matthew, on that point, I think there's not a lot of public sympathy for those teachers. And the feeling is that if principals have choice about what teachers to hire,
right,
and there are more teachers than there are teacher jobs, and those who can't get hired by principals on their own are now promised by this contract, which is something that's for them, promised by this contract that they have to be given auditions by principals at two different schools.
Right.
And then they fail those auditions in the eyes of the principals. Why aren't those the teachers to whom the taxpayer should say, okay, you're just not good enough at your job. This is a tiny fringe of maybe 1,000 out of 100,000 teachers in the system. Why not at that point say, you know, this is the worst of the worst and it's time to let them go?
That is a pretty compelling argument. I would just to relate it to my own experience. Right now I'm in a very good high school, Francis Lewis High School, and you know we always receive an A on our report card, and even actually Chancellor Walcott was an alumnus of our school. I only started working here though 2 years ago. My old school, Long Island City High School, was one of the 14 schools that was slated to be closed at the end of 2012. And at the end of that school year. And so I almost went into the ATR pool. Okay, now thank God I was able to get a job, and so I didn't go there. But it could, you know, I get very high ratings on all my observation stuff, and I'm in a good school, so everything's fine. But
yeah.
I just have the feeling that there are people who probably just wound up being in the wrong school at the wrong time, and they wound up in that ATR pool. I don't see it as being that they're the worst of the worst.
Matthew, thank you very much. And we heard again from Matthew, Richard Steyer, that the number one complaint that teachers have here is about how long this retro pay is being spread out over into the future. He talked about inflation eating away at it by the time they get to 2018, 2019, 2020. If someone leaves teaching between now and 2020, do they forfeit their retro pay? This is supposed to be pay for work they've already done in past years. If they leave the teaching force, they forfeit that supposedly retroactive pay?
They don't. They don't.
Oh, they don't.
The tentative deal basically requires that they remain on the payroll through June 30th of this year, at which point they are guaranteed to receive that retro pay. It just won't. I mean, they.
Are you sure? Because there are at least rumors circulating among teachers. I've heard from at least one teacher that they're not sure about this, and this is one of the things that they don't like. So can you, as a reporter on these issues, clarify this, that any teacher who just finishes out this school year for one more month is going to get all of these retro checks through 2020, whether or not they're teaching anymore?
I'm going to read you something that is on the UFT website pertaining to this, Brian. It states, retroactive money for the 4% raises in 2009 and 2010, those who retire on or before June 30th, 2014, will receive full retroactive pay for time worked in a lump sum. Those who retire after June 30th, 2014, and employees who have been continuously employed and are in active service as of the date of the payout will receive retroactive pay in five lump sum payments of roughly 12.5% in October 2015, 12.5% in October 2017, 25% in October 2018, 25% in October 2019, and 25% in October 2020.
That's pretty clear. And again, teachers and anyone else interested, we posted on our webpage a chart that the UFT sent around to its members outlining the timing of these retroactive payments, and you can see graphically laid out how spread out they are. So before you go, as someone who just wrote a book, Enough Blame to Go Around, The Labor Pains of New York City's Public Employee Unions, is this the most epic moment ever? Like your Super Bowl combined with your Kentucky Derby? Are you like going to be telling your grandkids about this moment?
Probably not. It's an interesting contract. It's a significant contract. In terms of the benefit, I think that if it's ratified, that de Blasio benefits more than the teachers do in terms of an economic aspect of it, that it's something that allows him to get his labor costs in line for basically the next 4 years, going past his first term, if there is, in fact, going to be a second term. For the teachers, they're getting all of this money, but it's as if after, in essence, having given the city a loan for the final term of Bloomberg's administration, that loan is carrying forward in large part before they're receiving that money. And when they receive it, they're not receiving it with any interest. I think that one of the things that's most appealing to Mike Mulgrew is that this could be the start of a good working relationship with both the mayor and the school's chancellor. And they've already seen what it's like when you don't have that good working relationship in ways that go beyond wages. And I think that he may have decided in terms of that, that it was important to do that. The other aspect of it is that the retroactive burden would have been so great if the city was paying it out all at once that there would have been probably no money available for raises beyond the retro period. Like this, basically what you're doing is you're creating some breathing room for the city, which allows it not only to be able to provide raises to the teachers beyond those 2-4% hikes, but to the rest of the workforce. That it's something that to some extent you're betting on the come. You have to hope that if de Blasio gets a second term, that by the time that you're negotiating again at the end of 2018, that the city is in a healthy surplus and can give you raises that you're sure are going to keep up with inflation. I think that in this case, the UFT was willing to gamble a bit on faith just in terms of being able to get that retro money and to have the promise of raises going out of the contract that are fairly decent.
Richard Steyer, editor of The Chief Leader and author of Enough Blame to Go Around. Thanks a lot.
Take care, Brian.